So this is Tara Krieger, she will be talking here on Andy Coakley versus the Cubs. And can you give me just a minute? I'm going to try to set this thing up. I need to get the presentation on here. Okay, you can get started. I'll get your presentation.
Okay, I'll just get started. So how many of you have heard of Andy Coakley? I imagine it's most of the room. Yeah, that's what I thought. You've probably heard of him in the context of basically two things. Number one, that he was Lou Gehrig's coach at Columbia, or number two, that he was the guy who wouldn't give his straw hat to Rube Waddell on a train, causing Rube Waddell to fall and hurt his arm and miss the World Series. But what probably people didn't know is the fact that he was a labor pioneer, or that's sort of the base of my talk. So some background on Andy is that he was born Andrew James Coakley in Providence, Rhode Island in 1882. He was a right-hand pitcher. He went to Holy Cross, where he was discovered by Connie Mack. He signed with the Philadelphia A's, first under an assumed name, but then he dropped out of Holy Cross and joined the team full-time around 1904. The quote is, "I definitely gave up college when they handed me a textbook entitled Ars Descendi. It was all in Latin, which was too much for me. It was much more fun to listen to Rube Waddell." So on the A's, his biggest season was 1905, when he was, at the time, a 20-game winner, although I'm not sure why, but I guess, you know, retrospective stats over time change. Now he's listed as having 118 games. But at the time, everyone said he was a 20-game winner. He went to dental school, he dropped out, and he was known for being very well-dressed, very well-spoken. The writers often called him the Beau Brummel of baseball because he was very well-educated and often made for a good, intelligent quote in the newspaper. He was traded to the Reds at the end of 1906 and pitched for them in 07 and 08, where he was primarily known as a hard luck pitcher. The Reds weren't very good, and for some reason, he just couldn't get any run support. By late August 1908, he was 8-18 with, I think it was a 1.86 ERA, which was the fifth best in the league. So he was getting a little restless, and he asked for the Reds to trade him. And at the time, the Cubs, they needed pitching, and they were obviously in a really tight pennant race with.
Keep going.
They're in a really tight pennant race with the Giants and the Pirates. I'm sure you all know. They traded for him on September 2nd, and the writers at the time, they said that, the Cincinnati Inquirer hailed the trade as like a really big win for the Cubs. They held it as a really big win for the Cubs. They said that, you know, Andy Mitt would have certainly won in three or four games. He was almost traded to the Giants. But they said that he would have won three or four games for the Giants. It would have been enough to change the championship tide in their favor. And he's one of the smartest and headiest pitchers in the league and a clean-cut athlete of education and intelligence. So as you see, on September 2nd, the Cubs were one game behind the Pirates and the Giants, and due in no small part to Fred Merkel and other happenstance, they won the pennant. They were one game ahead when the season ended, and Andy Coakley won two games. So partially because of him that they won the pennant, because they wouldn't have otherwise. And you know, then they went on to play in the World Series. They were world champions. As you can see, they used him in their marketing materials. He was on the team. Sporting Life did a thing. He was considered a big part of the team, even though he was only there for 1 month. He didn't play in the World Series because, you know, they're pretty set with their big three. So after the World Series, it was time to dole out the $10,000 World Series share, and they didn't give him any. He said, "Well, why not? I won two games. Without me, you wouldn't have won the world. Without me, you wouldn't have won." So, the Cubs said, well, yes, but, well, first of all, that there was some talk, at first, apparently Frank Chan said, well, I wanted to give it to him, but the player said that he shouldn't get some. And then later on during the offseason, the excuse was, well, you joined the team after August 31st, therefore you're technically ineligible, but other players who had joined the team late were also, some of them had also gotten World Series share. The big one was Rube Crowe, who gotten a smaller share, but then he protested and got, I think it was $500 at first, then he sort of made a sink and he got $1,400. And as you can see, that headline is actually from the Rube Crowe story, but basically it goes to sort of show what kind of mood the media was in that, you know, the World Series may be abolished because the players are asking for more of the share, more of the World Series share. And some of the writers are actually on Coakley's side. Ben Mulford said that his two wins might have been worth at least a couple of sandwiches. But yes, it seemed in general though, the players who protested not getting any World Series money, in spite of the fact that the Tigers had given everybody on their team a share of the winnings, so the papers alleged. Like Blaine Durbin and Jack Hayden, they were gone by early the next season. And some people wonder, well, why didn't people care about Andy Coakley? The Cubs may also have been a little worried because some of Andy Coakley's buddies were, he lived in New York during the offseason, and John McGraw, Christy Mathewson, Mike Donlin, those were his buddies on the Giants, and obviously the Cubs had no love for the Giants. And even though there was a claim he was given $500, it was clear he was never given it. So the solution was that he would ask for more money in his contract, maybe as a way of sort of making up for the World Series money he didn't get. And of course, the owners being the owners, they didn't want that. So he held out for most of the offseason. And while he was holding out, Cubs owner Charles Murphy threatens to ship him to the minors. He threatens to trade him, all kinds of stuff. And Frank Chance gets a little upset about the fact that Andy Coakley won't sign. He says he'll be sorry when the season opens if he doesn't sign soon. And he says that, and he also says that he didn't want, where's the quote? He pretty much says that, I don't want any dissatisfied players. Not only is it bad for him, but it gets others dissatisfied. One secret of our success is perfect harmony. He said that in February, Frank Chan said that in February of 1909. So eventually he signs, and he signs for $2,700, which, to give you an idea, the league average at the time, I think, was about $2,500, so a little bit above average. He said it was more than he expected, but less than he had hoped. But that's a week before the season, and he'd been only somewhat getting into shape in Providence and elsewhere. So he doesn't really join spring training until a week before the season. He basically has sort of an extended spring training where basically he doesn't really join the team until the middle of May. And at the time, Charles Murphy is still trying to make deals to get rid of him, I guess, in his salary. As you see, he pitched one game, I think it was early May, and you can see the stats weren't good. So shortly after that, they optioned him to Louisville for $1,500. And now, just interestingly, the $1,500 was actually a violation of an agreement the American Association had at the time, that they would only purchase players from the major leagues for $1,000. So it maybe kind of shows how badly they just wanted to get rid of him. So interestingly, and then his salary was pretty much cut down to about $800 when he was traded. Now, note that back then, in order to send a guy to the minors after you signed him, you had to put him on waivers, and you had to clear waivers, which means that the owners had to call every single team and basically say, you know, don't touch this guy, I want to send him out right to the minors, which means that Charles Murphy went around and just said, none of you guys better claim him, even though, you know, despite what he says. So he is insulted, of course, because he was a pretty good pitcher at the time, and he refuses to report to Louisville. There's no reason to go there. So he goes home to New York, and he pitches in outlaw leagues all summer. While Charles Murphy is still trying to trade him, but nothing ever goes through. As you can see, he pitches for like all kinds of leagues, and he starts semi-pro leagues as well. He starts a semi-pro league in Manhattan. At some point, he starts a semi-pro league in Paterson, New Jersey. And he's just kind of trying to get into baseball wherever he could. And this is a quote that he gave to Sporting Life. "To nurse a grievance requires no preliminary course in a training school or a hospital." So in the off season, he's still trying to secure his release, and he's still really upset with the Cubs. So he gets Dave Fultz to be his lawyer. Dave Fultz was actually a teammate of his on the O2 Athletics, and now he's an attorney. And he sues the Cubs for $3,280. $2,280, which was for breach of contract, because they only paid him $420 of the alleged $2,700 he would get, and the rest is for just a percentage of the Cubs' exhibition receipts, because that was part of the contract as well. So that suit is going on. They try to get Frank Chance to testify. It turns out Chance ends up not testifying. It's basically going on throughout the 1910 season. Meanwhile, William Grayson, the president of Louisville, is trying to get him to report, and he says, "I'm not going to Louisville. I have no business being there. You guys cut me." So William Grayson suspends him, and Andy Coakley continues doing his semi-pro stuff. The weather was pretty bad in New York earlier that season, apparently, and maybe he needed the money, I'm not sure. But he finally reports to Louisville at the end of June, and immediately he's there for about a week, and he's fined for alleged insubordination for $50. And then he's suspended around July 4th. So he really doesn't pitch very much, and that may be owing to a dispute with paying $55 in back pay on his contract. So Louisville, meanwhile, while he's suspended, Louisville sells him to Montreal. But Coakley again refuses to report because he doesn't believe he'd go there. So basically, the National Association of Professional Ball Players, we'll call them minors here for easy purpose of distinction. Secretary John Farrell goes to Gary Herman and tells the other clubs, "Don't sign Coakley, he's suspended, we will not play with him." But meanwhile, Coakley, he goes to Montreal, and interesting, the president of Montreal at the time is Ed Barrow, and he tells Ed Barrow, I want to be released from the team, and Ed Barrow says, "Okay, it's $500. So Coakley says, "All right." So he pays $500 basically to get himself released from Montreal, so he can sign with a team in the New York State League, Elmira. Meanwhile, Louisville is claiming that, well, he never reported to Montreal, so he's still their property. So they have a claim on him. They say, well, he's still under suspension, so he can't pitch for Elmira. Elmira doesn't have a claim for him. So the one game he does pitch is thrown out. And so he can't play for Elmira. He can't play in the minor leagues. So he goes back to his semi-pro club in Paterson. He starts arranging exhibition games with major league clubs, with the Giants and with the Yankees, Highlanders at the time. And the John Farrell gets wind of that and basically goes to Gary Herman and says, this guy's suspended by the minor leagues. So Gary Herman says, okay, he's suspended by the major leagues too. So he's pretty much banned from all baseball by September of 1910, simply because of more money. So Coakley actually believed the reason John Farrell did this was he was trying to absorb his Paterson club into the New York State League. He threatened to sue Farrell. It doesn't really happen. And he even offers to pay Louisville the $50 fine that he owed them earlier in the year. And Louisville says, no, that's not going to lift the suspension. So Coakley says he feels like he's been double-crossed 17 different ways by the National Association. As you can see, these are some of the quotes in some of the newspapers. I think I got them from Sporting Life. I forgot to put the But they called him a stormy petrel of a game, a victim of organized ball tyranny. And the National Commission is now through with Coakley, and the latter is thrust upon the tender mercy of a body which commits trifling or defiance by any player, however great or humble. So how does it get reinstated? Well, it's a little unclear, but basically he goes at the winter meetings in December 1910. He tries to reinstate it, and they said, well, if you drop your suit against the Cubs, we will reinstate you. And he says, I'm not dropping my suit, I don't trust you. In January of 1911, he applies for reinstatement, and eventually they reinstate him. And I have a couple theories on why. The newspapers aren't very clear why he was reinstated. But first of all, around the time he applied for reinstatement, Gary Herman, who probably liked him a little bit because, interestingly, he's doing scouting for the Reds at the time, and Gary Herman, of course, is the owner of the Reds. So while he's suspended, he is going out and finding players for them. So Gary Herman probably wanted to reinstate him, and his hands were probably tied earlier in terms of suspending him. So when he applies for him, they go and they look and they find that there are 450 minor leaguers who have also been suspended without on suspended lists for no reason. So maybe reinstating him was sort of a way to kind of save face a little bit. And then it also may have been because it's not really sure what happened with the lawsuit. It just says it was settled privately in the accounts I found. So maybe he worked out a deal that he'd be reinstated if he dropped the lawsuit or settled it or something of the sort. As you can see, the Sporting Life pretty much says, so another case of insubordination ends with the submission of the offender to the necessary discipline of organized ball. So what happened after? So afterwards, now that he's back in baseball, he goes and he signs with the New York Highlanders. And maybe it's because he hadn't pitched full time for 2 years or who knows why. The reports maybe he had a sore finger. He pitches 2 games, he falls flat on his face, he's released by them. He goes to play some minor league ball, owns a few semi-pro clubs, but eventually he's out of baseball. And around the time of his suspension, actually, one of his projects was he had been offered a coaching position at Williams College. And he was coaching at Williams, I guess, during the spring. And then eventually he gets offered the position at Columbia in 1914 as a pitching coach, and then is promoted to head coach in 1915. He stays there until 1951. So he did okay for himself. I think partially is because he maintained some of the friendships with the other people in baseball. Meanwhile, Dave Fultz used his case basically as one of the reasons why they formed the Baseball Players Fraternity, which was one of the early unions, in December of 1912. And he talks about how Coakley is released and he's sent to the minors for $800. You know, his salary was cut to $800 from $2,700. He really had no choice, and even after he paid to be released from Montreal, they still wouldn't let him go because the fact that he was kind of at the mercy of the owners. The big idea of the players' fraternity was to secure justice for players and eliminate the high-handed methods of club owners. And you saw some of the players basically at the time. They were more or less. They were on Andy Coakley's side a little bit. Like Joe Tinker, for instance, brought up the fact that Andy Coakley set a precedent about being when he refused to report after he was released to the minors for no reason, and basically how that sort of paved the way for what the Cubs did to Mordecai Three Finger Brown a few years later. So in that they released him when they didn't want him anymore, and they just found a way to kind of send him to the minors, and that was basically because of Andy Coakley. So a final thought is that when they were justifying the players' fraternity, this is probably one of the last accounts I could find of Andy Coakley's suit in the newspaper, the fact that instead of blaming on the owners, some of the writers pretty much said that his trouble was started by the players themselves when they didn't give him World Series money. And basically they blamed it on the money-mad associates on the playing field rather than the owners for why he was banned from baseball. So that's basically my talk. Questions?
Did the club players explain why they weren't giving Coakley anything?
You know, it's unclear. It's unclear even if it was the players who voted against it or whether that was just the initial excuse they gave. Because initially, it was Frank Chance pretty much said, well, I couldn't do it, the players wouldn't give it. And then you see several months later, Charles Murphy is saying, well, he's ineligible anyway. And Frank Chance is saying, yeah, Charles Murphy is right. So it's kind of unclear even if the player said anything.
If you have a question, please come up to the microphone because it's hard for folks in the back to hear the question. Thanks.
So were there players who left the team before the end of the season that got shares?
You mean who left this, you mean in 1908?
Players who were there earlier in the season and maybe were optioned out or
That's a good question. I don't know for sure. I was trying to find that out because I thought, well, if that's the case, then obviously. I didn't see any, but I also didn't see a list of the players who did get shares. The criteria eventually when they gave out the World Series shares in June of 1909 was that it was for players who helped win the 1908 pennant and who were helping them in 1909 to win another pennant. That was what Charles Murphy said when they raised the flag. So I would think the answer is no, but I don't want to definitively say no because I didn't see an actual list.
Could you give us a sense of maybe Coakley's career success? Do you have any of his statistics, for example?
Yeah, he was actually, I mean, he had some pretty good years. His best year was probably 1905 when he went 18 and I think it was 18 and 8, and you know, he was basically their number four starter at the time behind Waddell, Bender, and Plank. He, a few years after that, I mean, he still had some good, he still was pretty successful in 06, 07, but the problem was he partially was apparently not very healthy for some reason. So he didn't pitch as much as he could have, but when he did pitch, he was pretty good, and by 08 he was back and he was pitching, you know, he pitched like 260 something innings. He was considered a pretty solid guy to have around and guys liked him. So he actually, so at the time when he was, I think he was 26 or so, he seemed like he was on the verge of becoming really good, and then all this happened, and that might have been why he didn't.
Could you give us an idea how much money he was looking for and what other people in similar predicaments that came in the late August, early September were getting?
I don't know per se. I know that I want to say the top salary at the time was either maybe 4,600, 6,000, I can't remember, but I remember like...
And the World Series bonus.
Oh, the World Series bonus. I think he was just, I think he was just looking for something. I don't think he was really looking for, you know, just some sort of acknowledgement that he did something. As it was, Rube Crow, who had joined the team and only won one game and had joined the team in mid-August, he asked for 500 and he got 1400, and that's just for being on the team for about a month and a half. So he probably expected someone in there, or even if they had given him $500, maybe he would have been happy, but they gave him nothing. So just, you know, not acknowledgement of what he did.
Terry, you finished up by quoting Sporting Life, reporting that the matter essentially had been settled and that yet another player had submitted to organized baseball. Do you see anything else coming out of this incident in the development of the rules of the major leagues with respect to things like World Series share, or was this just an isolated event where a fairly well-educated unusually well-educated ball player made a stink and was ostracized for it?
Well, I don't think it was an isolated event, because I saw there were several players who also wanted a share of the World Series money. I think it was happening pretty frequently, because the two other guys on the team who made us think about it, Durbin and Frazier, they were both out of baseball basically by the beginning of the next year. So I get the impression, and just I was trying to find out whether or not it happened on other teams, I'm sure it did, that at least on the Cubs, they basically did it to shut people up, to, you know, they said, will you just be happy with what you get, or we're getting rid of you.
Tara, thanks so much. We appreciate that. Thank you.